Part 2. In a country where youth is adored, we lost ours before we were out of our 20s. We learned to accept death there, and it erased our sense of immortality. We met our human frailties, the dark side of ourselves, face to face. The war destroyed our faith, betrayed our trust, and dropped us outside the mainstream of our society. We still don't fully belong. I wonder if we ever will. Winnie Smith, American Daughter Gone to War. 23. Virginia, April 1971. At 25, Frankie moved with the kind of caution that came with age. She was constantly on guard, aware that something bad could happen at any moment. She trusted neither the ground beneath her feet nor the sky above her head. Since coming home from war, she had learned how fragile she was, how easily upended her emotions could be. Still, she had learned to hide her outbursts, her crying jags, even from her two best friends, who, for most of their first year in Virginia, had watched her intently, trying constantly to divine her moods, assess her level of self-destruction, her grief and anger. In the beginning, it had been difficult, settling into the time-honored McGrath camouflage of, "I'm okay." The nightmares had been terrible when she first arrived here, had still wrenched her out of sleep and sent her careening onto the floor. But time, and friendship, had done exactly as promised. Pain and grief had grown soft in her hands, almost pliable. She found she could form them into something kinder if she was deliberate in thought and action, if she lived a careful, cautious life, if she stayed away from anything that reminded her of the war, of loss, of death. By Christmas of that first year, she'd felt strong enough to write to her mother, who had promptly written back. In their family's way, neither spoke of the terrible night that had precipitated Frankie's flight across the country. They simply merged back onto their familiar road, the ground a little bumpy between them, but both determined to stay the course. Frankie remembered and often reread that first letter from her mother. "I am so grateful to your army girlfriends for being there for you when your father and I were not. We love you, and if we don't say it often enough, it is because we grew up in families where there was no such vocabulary. About your father and his reticence about you and the war. All I can say is that something in him was broken by being unable to serve his country. All the men of his generation went to Europe while he stayed home. Yes, he was proud of Finley and ashamed of you, but perhaps in truth he is ashamed of himself and worries that you judge him harshly as he feared his friends had done." Frankie never spoke about her struggles, tried never to say Vietnam out loud, and when she felt a rise in her blood pressure, a flood of grief or anger, she smiled tautly and left whatever room she was in. She'd learned that people noticed a raised voice. Quiet was the perfect camouflage for pain. Initially, it had been almost impossible to sever Vietnam from her life story. The world, it seemed, had conspired against such a healing. The war was constantly in conversation, in bars, in living rooms, on the television. Everyone had an opinion. Now the majority of Americans seemed to be against the war and the men who fought it. In 1969, the world had learned about the horrifying massacre at My Lai, where American soldiers had killed as many as 500 unarmed South Vietnamese civilians, men, women, and children in their village. It had intensified the baby killer talk about vets, more and more of whom were turning to heroin in country and coming home addicted. America was losing the war. That was obvious to everyone except Nixon, who kept lying to the people and sending soldiers off to war, too many of whom came home in body bags. Each of the women had responded differently to the rising tide of violence that was ripping the country apart, dividing young from old, rich from poor, conservative from liberal. Ethel was in her third year of veterinary school and worked part-time with her father. She and Noah had begun to talk of marriage, kids. The two of them never missed a Sunday at church or a local high school football game. Their fondness for casseroles and cribbage had created long-standing jokes between the women. Ethel had grown up on this farm, among these people, and she intended to be buried here. So she kept her head down and did her job and said nothing controversial to her friends and neighbors. "This war will be over soon," she always said, "but I'll always live here. My kids will be in 4-H. I'll probably run the damned PTA. Barb was the opposite in every way. She'd become a vocal, participatory member of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. She went to meetings, she painted signs, she protested. And not just the war. She lobbied for passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. She marched for a woman's right to a safe abortion and basic health care. When she wasn't trying to change the world, she earned money by bartending. It was, she said, a great job for a woman who hadn't yet decided where she belonged. Frankie, on the other hand, had found her way back through nursing. She'd put up with the initial prejudice and disregard for her Vietnam training and become determined to show her skills. She'd worked harder and longer than most of the other nurses, put in the hours, and had taken specialized classes. In time, she'd become a surgical nurse. Now she was working toward a specialization in trauma surgery. On this cool April morning, she woke well before the dawn and dressed for writing. It would be cold out, a spring crispness in the air. She had come to love the sweet-smelling air of the South, the way mist clung to the grass in the morning. It calmed the tumult in her soul. Today, the cherry trees along the driveway were in full pink bloom. Ethel had been right all those years ago when she'd said that riding horses was restorative to one's sense of peace. Frankie loved the undulating green fields, the black four-rail fencing, the trees that changed their color with the weather. Now, the leaves were the bright lime hue of new growth and full of pink blossoms. But mostly, it was being around the horses that calmed Frankie. Ethel had been right about that. Riding had steadied Frankie as much as friendship had. Frankie ducked through the empty space between fence rails and headed into the barn. She could barely see her boots, the mist was so thick and gray. Inside, the barn smelled of manure and fresh bales of hay and the grain they stored in large metal garbage cans. The horses nickered at her as she passed. At the last stall on the left, she paused and lifted the latch. Silver Birch walked toward her, lips moving, looking for treats, breath snorting. "Hey, girl," Frankie said, holding out her gloved hand. Silver ate the grain messily, more falling to the ground than getting in her mouth. Frankie led the mare out into the aisle and saddled her quickly, pressing a knee to the mare's belly to aid her in tightening the girth. In no time, Frankie and Silver were out on the trails, galloping through the mist. When Silver started to sound winded, Frankie slowed the mare to a trot, then a walk. They walked home slowly, clomping at a steady, calming pace. Back in the barn, she fed and watered the horses, turned Silver out, and headed back to the small bunkhouse. Early morning sunlight drenched the fields. Off to the left was the main house with its steeply pitched roof, large and welcoming porch, and whitewashed wooden sides, where Ethel lived with her father. Well off to the right was the bunkhouse that had once boarded farm workers. Over the past 18 months, it had been remodeled into a two-bedroom cottage where Frankie and Barb lived. The three women had learned how to paint, demolish, rebuild, and do rudimentary plumbing. They'd spent hours haunting garage sales and hauling other people's junk to be their treasures. Many evenings were spent sitting around the sooty River Rock fireplace talking. They never ran out of things to say. Frankie climbed the few steps and went into the bunkhouse's only bathroom, where she showered, changed, and dressed for work. She was out of the house and on her way to work before Barb was even out of bed. At the end of a 12-hour shift in the OR, Frankie waved goodbye to her coworkers and headed out to her car, a dented old Ford Falcon that she and Barb shared, and jumped in. On the way out of town, she popped a John Denver tape into the A-track and sang along. She drove to the tavern where Barb currently worked and parked among the battered old trucks of the regulars who were there this time of day. Barb's bicycle stood slanted against the rough exterior plank wall, Inside, the place was dark and musty-smelling, with sawdust on the floors and bar stools worn to a velvet feel by 100 years of faithful customers. Barb had worked here for the past few months. It was not a job she intended to keep much longer. Or so she often said. Soon she'd look for something higher end, nearer to the city, where the tips were better. But this was close to the farm and gave her lots of time to volunteer for her causes. Now she stood behind the bar, a soggy bar rag over one shoulder, a red, white, and blue cotton kerchief over her afro. Huge gold hoop earrings caught the light. Frankie sidled up onto a bar stool. "Hey there."
"Jed, I'm taking a break,"
Barb called out. A moment later, her boss, Jed, shuffled out from the office and took his place behind the bar. Barb grabbed a pair of cold beers and led the way out back to one of the picnic tables. Come summer, the bar would sell house-smoked barbecue on red plastic plates, but not till the weather warmed up. Frankie took the beer, snapped the cap, and took a long drink, leaning back against the table, stretching her legs out. She glanced at Barb, frowned, and said,
"What's wrong?"
"You can read my thoughts now?"
"This is not a new skill, Barbara. What's up?"
"Damn it, I was going to ease my way into it."
She sighed.
"I have a favor to ask."
"Anything, you know that."
"It's for all of them," Barb said. "Finley and Jamie and Ryan, all the fallen."
Frankie flinched. The names were rarely mentioned between them. Barb and Ethel still worried that Frankie was fragile and could slide too easily back into grief. And they were right to be concerned. Frankie still sometimes woke up and for a split second forgot that Rye was gone and reached for him.
"The VVAW are meeting in Washington next week to protest. Guerrilla theater, they're calling it."
"Vietnam Veterans Against the War."
"You know I'm not interested."
"You've asked before," Frankie said.
"I'm not a marcher.
This is special, trust me. We aren't the only group that will march. We want to create a media event so big Nixon has to notice."
Barb looked at her.
"Come with me."
"Barb, you know I try not to think about
over there. I know, and I respect the effort. I know how hard it's been for you,
but they're still dying in the jungle, Frankie. Dying for a lost war, and, well,
you told me to do something for Will. This is what I'm doing."
"Not fair throwing my words back at me."
"I know, I know. It's shitty, but we're believers, you and me,"
Barb said.
"As banged around as we've been, and as much as we've seen, we're patriots."
"No one wants patriots anymore," Frankie said.
"I can't wear an army t-shirt off the property or I'll be spit on. The country thinks we're monsters.
But I won't disrespect the troops."
"It's not disrespectful to protest, Frankie. We had that wrong. It takes guts to stand up and demand a change.
We're vets. Shouldn't our voices be heard in protest too? Shouldn't they be loud?"
Barb pulled a folded-up magazine page out of her back pocket, smoothed out the wrinkles, and laid it out on the table. It was a full-page ad in Playboy for the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. The picture was of a solitary coffin draped in an American flag. The headline read, "In the last 10 years, over 335,000 of our buddies have been killed or wounded in Vietnam, and more are being killed every day. We don't think it's worth it." In the bottom corner of the ad was a plea to join us. Frankie stared at the advertisement. Since the tide of public opinion had turned so clearly against the war, more and more numbers of the wounded and fallen were being reported. It was tough to see in print. So many young men killed, while others were still being shipped over, spun up. The press wasn't blindly reporting what Nixon wanted them to anymore. Journalists had been granted access to the troops. They witnessed the battles, reported on the dead. This week, a female journalist from Australia had been among a group captured by the People's Army of Vietnam and taken prisoner, Kate Webb. Everyone should now know that women were in Vietnam, too. Frankie took a deep breath, exhaled. Barb said,
"Slim told me once that the average life expectancy of a helicopter pilot in Vietnam is 30 days.
"I know. I've heard that, too," I don't know if it's true.
We have to stop it, Barb said. Us, the ones who paid the price.
It was wrong, criminal, the way the U.S. government was failing the military. But what could a handful of veterans do to stop a war? People like Barb had been marching for years, and what good had it done? Protest seemed futile, maybe even unpatriotic. But men were dying over there, crashing in helicopters and stepping on landmines and getting shot by an enemy they never saw. How could she not protest that, at least?
We could be arrested, Frankie said.
They could call in the National Guard. We could be tear gassed or shot at, Barb said solemnly, then added, like at Kent State in Jackson.
Way to look at the bright side.
This isn't a joke, Barb said. The old white men who run this country are scared, and people do stupid, ugly things when they're scared. She leaned close.
But they're counting on their power and our fear. And every minute, some woman's son is being killed over there. Some girl's brother.
Frankie didn't want to march. She didn't want to think about Vietnam and what it had cost her. She wanted to do what she'd been trying to do for more than 2 years. Forget. It was dangerous, what Barb was asking of Frankie, an upsetting of an already precariously balanced peace in Frankie's mind. No fear, McGrath. Jamie's voice in her head. Barb was right. Frankie needed to do this. As a veteran of Vietnam, and for Finley and Jamie and Rye, she had to add her voice to the rising scream of dissent. She had to say, no more.
Just this once, Frankie said.
She regretted it almost instantly. On the day before the march, Frankie had trouble concentrating at work. In between surgeries, she worried about what lay ahead. Her mind obsessively scrolled through the violence that had marked so many rallies and protests. Nixon had sent the National Guard in to stop a peaceful protest at Kent State less than a year ago. When the smoke cleared, 4 students were dead and dozens wounded. Only 11 days later, the police had shot students at a Jackson State College war protest. But the truth was that although she worried about violence at the march, she worried more about standing there with other veterans saying, "I was there." For the past 2 years, she'd hidden that fact at every opportunity, changed the conversation when Vietnam came up. Even Barb and Ethel rarely mentioned Vietnam. Frankie knew their silence was to protect her, and on good days, she knew it helped. On bad days, she worried that she couldn't forget because there was something wrong with her, something broken. In time, hiding her service and not talking about it had allowed shame to take root. She was never exactly sure what she was ashamed of, just that she was weak or had somehow done something bad, been a part of something bad, something no one wanted to talk about. Maybe it was simply being a part of the apparent breakdown of American honor. She didn't know. On the way home, she tried to figure out what the hell one should wear to a protest meeting. She decided on hip-hugger jeans with a wide Western-style belt and a ribbed white turtleneck. She dried her hair down straight from a center part. At the last minute, she went in search of her ANC pin, a brass caduceus with its wings behind a bold N, and pinned it on her sweater. Leaving her bedroom, she shut the door behind her. In the kitchen, Barb and Ethel were talking quietly. Barb wore her old stained fatigue pants with a black turtleneck and a Levi's jacket with the sleeves cut off. Dozens of the pins and patches she'd collected from friends and patients in Vietnam decorated the front of the vest. She'd drawn a big black peace symbol on the back. She'd painted a "Bring Them Home" sign and stapled it to a yardstick. Ethel, wearing her blue lab coat, poured herself a cup of coffee.
I don't know how Barb talked you into this, Frank. The VVAW is as sexist as the SDS, she added. If you girls show up, they'll ask you to make coffee and do snack runs.
Those who stay behind don't get to bitch, Barb said.
Disappointingly, Frankie said glumly. The three of them had spent at least an hour last night sitting around the fire pit in the backyard, wrapped in woolen blankets, discussing today's march.
Barb had said that more than a dozen anti-war groups were scheduled to arrive in D.C. in the next few days. The VVAW wanted to separate themselves by marching first. They had big plans to draw attention to themselves, make the news broadcasts.
"Just be careful," Ethel said. "Be home on time or I'm calling the police."
Barb laughed. "If we get into trouble, it will be with the police." Frankie stared at her friend.
"Comments like that are not helpful."
"Come on, kid," Barb said. "We're making like the wind and blowing."
Ethel hugged Frankie and said,
"Go with God, girls. Change the world."
Frankie followed Barb out to the car and got into the passenger seat. Barb started the car and cranked up the music on Creedence. Barb turned, smiling.
"You ready?"
Frankie sighed. Her nerves were strung taut. This whole thing was a mistake.
"Just drive, Barbara."
It was nearing midnight when they pulled into D.C. Their destination, Potomac Park, was a black expanse in the middle of the brightly lit city. In the darkness, Frankie could make out tents here and there. The VVAW had occupied the park, turned it into a campground.
"Let's find a spot off to ourselves," Frankie said.
Barb parked the car on the side of the street.
"Get the tent out of the trunk."
Across the street, a long line of policemen in riot gear stood shoulder to shoulder.
"Don't say anything," Frankie warned as they passed the policemen on their way to the park. "I mean it. I'm not getting arrested before the march."
Barb gave a curt nod. They came to the edge of the large park. Saying nothing, not to each other and not to the other VVAW campers, they pitched their tent, then set up two chairs out front. As they sat in the dark, listening to the din of tent spikes being pounded into the ground, more and more cars drove up, headlights spearing through the night. They heard music in the distance and the quiet buzz of conversations.
"I wonder if we are the only women," Frankie said, drinking coffee from a thermos.
Barb sighed.
"Aren't we always?"
In the morning, when Frankie stepped out of the tent, she found herself standing amid a veritable sea of male veterans, thousands, most of them about her age, wearing worn, stained fatigues and jeans and boonie hats. Some wore peace symbols and carried flags from their states, their units. Hundreds of cars were parked near the park, their doors emblazoned with slogans, convoys from California and Colorado. More had parked on the grass. As she stood there, a battered, beaten-up school bus drove up onto the grass, stopped, and opened its doors. Veterans exited the bus, singing, "What's it good for? Absolutely nothing." In the center of the park, a bushy-haired man with a bullhorn jumped up into the back of a pickup truck onto which someone had spray-painted "No More."
"My brothers in arms, it's time! We're marching to be heard today! We're raising our voices, but not our fists, not our guns, to say, enough! Bring our soldiers home! Line up behind Ron in the wheelchair, a single unbroken column. Be peaceful. Don't give the man any reason to stop us. Let's go!"
The men slowly formed a column, led by several veterans in wheelchairs who held flags. Behind them were men on crutches, men with burned faces and missing arms, blind men being led by their friends. Barb and Frankie were the only two women in the park that they could see. They held hands and joined their brothers on the march across the Lincoln Memorial Bridge. Vietnam veterans, a river of them, marching and chanting, holding signs in the air. More men joined them, rushed forward, yelling out slogans, signs raised. Someone bumped into Frankie so hard that she stumbled sideways, lost her hold on Barb's hand, and fell to the ground. She yelled, "Barb!" and heard, "Frankie!" But men swarmed in between them. Frankie couldn't see her friend in the crowd.
"Meet back at the tent,"
she yelled, hoping Barb could hear.
"You okay, ma'am?"
A man helped her to her feet. He was young, blonde, with a scraggly reddish-blonde beard and mustache. He held on to her upper arm, steadied her. He wore torn, stained jungle fatigues with the sleeves cut off. He'd drawn a huge peace symbol on his helmet.
In his other hand, he held a sign that read Vietnam Veterans Against the War. The protesters kept moving, shoving the two of them forward.
Stop the war! Bring them home! Stop the war! Bring them home!
You should move to the side, ma'am, he said.
Someone jostled Frankie again. She stumbled.
I'm here to march.
Sorry, lady. This march is for vets. We're trying to make a statement. Hopefully that asshole in the White House will listen to us and stop lying to the country.
I'm a veteran, she said.
Oh, Vietnam, he said impatiently, looking ahead.
I was there.
There weren't women in Nam.
The chanting grew louder.
Stop the war! Bring them home!
If you didn't meet someone like me, you were lucky. It means
just move to the side, ma'am. This is for the men who were fighting. In combat, you know?
He disappeared into the moving crowd full of military shirts and bare chests and fatigues, long hair and afros and helmets.
What the hell? So she didn't belong here either?
I was there!
She screamed in frustration. She muscled her way forward, melded into the throng of protesters as they crossed the bridge.
Stop the war!
She said, raising her fist.
Bring them home!
Her voice was nothing amid the yelling, but she kept shouting, saying it louder and louder until she was screaming at Nixon, at the administration, at the North Vietnamese. The more she shouted, the angrier she became. By the time they reached Arlington National Cemetery, with all those white crosses planted in the trimmed green grass, she was furious. At Arlington Cemetery, policemen moved in to stop a group of black-clad women who carried wreaths.
They're Gold Star mothers, someone yelled. Let them through!
Let them through! Let them through! Let them through! The crowd chanted.
The Gold Star mothers stood outside the entrance to the cemetery in a small clot, all in black, their movements blocked. It seemed they didn't know where to go. None dropped their floral wreaths. Gold Star mothers, women who had lost their sons in Vietnam, being denied the opportunity to put wreaths on their sons' graves. One of the mothers looked up, her cheeks lined with tears, and met Frankie's gaze. It made her think of her mother and the loss of her brother. Losing Finley had destroyed their family. How dare the cops haul Gold Star mothers away from their sons' graves? The mood of the marchers changed. Frankie felt the outrage, the anger. Frankie joined her voice in the chanting.
Let them in!
Hell no! We don't want your war!
A helicopter flew threateningly over the crowd. Frankie heard the familiar thwop, thwop, thwop and thought of all the men who died. And she knew that helicopters had guns.
Bring them home!
She screamed.
End the war!
2 days later, Frankie and Barb were back in D.C. as hundreds of thousands of protesters poured into the city, coming together from side streets, from parks, from across the bridge. Not just veterans anymore. College kids, professors, men and women from all across the country. Women pushing strollers, men with small children on their shoulders. The denial of the Gold Star mothers to mourn their sons on the day of the VVAW march had been shown on every news show across America. It had become the perfect visual reminder of how far wrong America had gone on Vietnam. Mothers not allowed to visit their sons' graves. Men decimated by the war, torn apart on the battlefield, and forgotten at home. It was wrong. Frankie had been told often enough by her girlfriends, by Finley, by Jamie, that she was unyielding in her morality. And it was true. Deep down, she was still the good Catholic girl she'd been in her youth. She believed in good and evil, right and wrong, the dream of America. Who would she be if she chose to look away from the wrongness of this war? Today, she stood again with Barb on Constitution Avenue, a part of this larger, angrier crowd, two women in a vast sea of people carrying signs, veterans in wheelchairs raising their fists in anger. This second march on Washington in a week had drawn dozens of anti-war groups. It was to be a massive protest, to last for days, a tidal wave of anti-war sentiment to flood the White House and the Capitol. All of it would be captured by news crews and broadcast into every living room in America. Barb raised her sign. It read, "Bring the troops home now." The Vietnam veterans against the war were easily recognizable in their fatigues and patched-up jean jackets and boonie hats. But there were thousands of other protesters. Hippies and college kids stood with men in suits and women in dresses. Nuns, priests, doctors, teachers. Anyone with a voice who wanted to demand that Nixon stop the war. Frankie and Barb held hands as they marched, but this time they understood the risks better and had agreed to meet at a local hotel if they got separated. Barb stuck her sign in the air, yelled, "Bring them home! Bring them home!" The marchers came to a stop at the Capitol steps, pressed in together, shoulder to shoulder. Men raised their voices and their signs, yelling, "Stop the war! Bring them home!" while television news crews filmed it all. A man with long hair, wearing fatigues, stepped forward, stood alone for a moment. The crowd fell silent. A wave of anticipation swept through the VVAW group, and then something flew through the air from the protest crowd, sailed over the barricade, and landed on the Capitol steps with a clink, glinted in a ray of sunlight. A war medal. One by one, veterans stepped forward, stood alone, ripped medals off of their chests, and threw them, clanging, onto the steps. Purple hearts, bronze stars, good conduct medals, dog tags. Some hit the steps and clanked against the sudden silence of the crowd. Barb let go of Frankie, pushed her way to the front of the crowd, and threw her first lieutenant's bars onto the steps. Police in riot gear, helmeted with plastic shields up, arrived in a blare of whistles. They charged the crowd, began hauling the protesters away. The crowd broke up. Pandemonium filled the streets. Frankie was knocked off her feet, fell hard. In the confusion, she curled into a small ball and rolled away, trying to protect herself from both protesters and police. She edged toward the chain-link fence barricade and lay there, panting, feeling bruised. Tear gas floated through the air, stung Frankie's eyes, and blurred her vision until she could barely see. How long did she lie there, blinking, her eyes on fire? She didn't know. Slowly, she got to her feet, trying to focus. The street was full of police in riot gear, hauling protesters away, cars honking, driving away, news vans following. Half blind, Frankie stumbled forward, unable to quite comprehend everything she'd just seen, the deep and utter wrongness of it. The street was littered with cigarette butts, protest brochures, broken signs, ripped up draft cards. On the steps of the Capitol, behind the temporary chain-link fencing, hundreds of medals glittered in the sunlight. Medals that had cost each recipient so much, thrown away in protest. A lone policeman began picking them up. What would happen to them, the medals men had sacrificed and bled for? Frankie grabbed the chain-link fence, shook it hard.
"Don't you touch those!"
A man grabbed her by the arm.
"Don't," he said. "They'll arrest you."
She tried to pull free.
"I don't care!"
Suddenly, she was furious. How dare the American government do these things to her own citizens? Stop mothers from honoring their fallen sons? Ignore the meaning of a medal thrown through the air? She wiped her eyes again, tried to clear her vision.
"They shouldn't be allowed to touch those medals."
"The vets made their point. A damn good one," the man said. "That image will stay with people. A vet in a wheelchair throwing his purple heart away? Powerful man."
Frankie pulled back, wrenched her arm free. The man who'd stopped her wasn't what she expected. In the first place, he was older than most of the protesters, certainly older than most of the Vietnam vets. Long dark hair fell in feathery layers almost to his shoulders and was threaded through with gray. A thick mustache covered his upper lip. He wore round John Lennon sunglasses, but even so, she could see how green his eyes were. You're a Vietnam vet? She said, trying to find her calm again. All of this had upset her, dredged up emotions she didn't want to feel. She had to dial it back, and fast. Losing her Vietnam emotions was never good.
No, just someone who's against the war. Henry Acevedo.
He held out his hand. She shook it distractedly.
Frankie McGrath, did you have a son in Vietnam?
He laughed. I'm not that old. I'm here for the same reason you are. To say enough is goddamn enough.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Henry.
Frankie walked away. Henry fell into step beside her.
Do you think these protests will do any good? She asked.
We have to try, was his answer.
Yeah, Frankie thought. It's true. She'd seen people hauled away by the police today, risking their freedom to protest a war many of them hadn't even fought. Civilians were being arrested for exercising the fundamental American right to protest their government. At Kent State and in Jackson, they'd been shot for it. She didn't know if protesting and marching and making signs could actually affect change, but she damn sure knew that America wasn't preserving democracy or fighting communism in Vietnam, and it certainly wasn't winning. Ultimately, too many lives would be lost in pursuit of nothing.
Can I buy you a drink? Henry asked.
Frankie had almost forgotten the older man was with her. She'd been lost in the wilds of her own past. They'd walked almost two blocks together. She stopped, looked at him. Long, wild hair, bright green eyes, lines that hinted at sorrow, a nose that looked as if it had been broken more than once. Worn, faded Levi's, a Rolling Stones t-shirt, sandals. He looked like a Berkeley philosophy professor.
Why?
He shrugged.
Why not? I feel bereft, I guess. That was tough to watch.
What man used the word bereft?
Are you a philosophy professor? Or a surfer, maybe?
Good guess. Psychiatrist. And yeah, I surf. Grew up in La Jolla. That's in Southern California.
Frankie smiled.
I'm a Coronado Island girl. My brother and I used to surf Trestles and Black's Beach.
Small world.
Frankie felt a kinship with him. She liked that he was a surfer, that he knew Trestles, and that he was here, standing against a war he'd had no part in.
I could use a drink. I'm supposed to meet my girlfriend at the Hay Adams. We got separated.
They turned in tandem, heading toward the hotel. Across the street, a small table had been positioned beneath a banner that read, "Don't let them be forgotten." At the table, behind stacks of anti-war flyers, two long-haired men with unruly sideburns sat in folding chairs.
"Hey, lady, want to buy a bracelet and help bring a POW home?"
Frankie walked over to the table, looked down at a cardboard box full of silver metal bracelets.
"They're $5 apiece," the guy behind the table said.
Frankie pulled one of the bracelets out. It was a thin silver cuff with Major Robert Welch, 1/16/1967, engraved on it.
"We're a student organization," one of the kids said. "We're raising money. We work with the League of POW MIA Families. It's a new organization."
"League of Families?" Frankie asked.
"Navy wives, mostly, fighting to bring their husbands home. There's a fundraiser in town next week, if you'd like to join the effort. Here's a flyer. They need donations."
Frankie took the flyer, handed the guy $10, and put the bracelet on. She and Henry walked to the hotel, past a worried-looking doorman who seemed ready to stop them, but didn't. They went downstairs, into the sexy basement bar where it was rumored that much of the country's governing decisions were made by men drinking martinis. They chose a booth in the back. He ordered a beer, she a gin martini. On the table in front of them, a pair of coasters showed a caricature of President Nixon. Frankie realized her hands were shaking, so she lit up a cigarette. The bartender brought over a small bowl full of homemade potato chips. She sipped her drink, which helped to ease the slight tremor in her hands. Her eyes still stung, but her vision had cleared. Cigarette smoke wafted between them. Someone in here was smoking a cigar, too.
"Who did you lose to Vietnam?" Henry asked. She put down her glass. There was something in the way he looked at her, a quiet compassion, maybe, a depth of caring she was unused to. It's a long list.
A brother?
He was the first, yeah, but there were others. He said nothing more, but didn't look away. She had a feeling he saw more than most people. The silence became unnerving. I was there, she said in a soft voice, surprising herself with the admission.
I see the pin, he said. You're Caduceus. Wings. You're a nurse. I've heard stories about women like you.
How? No one talks about the war. No one who was there, anyway.
I treat a few vets in my practice. Alcoholics, addicts, mostly. Do you have nightmares, Frankie? Trouble sleeping?
Before Frankie could answer, deflect, Barb showed up, panting and out of breath. She slid into the booth, bumped Frankie hard.
Did you see us throw the medals? That will make the news.
She raised a hand to the bartender, yelled, Rum and Coke! Henry was already sliding out of the booth, standing. He looked down at Frankie.
It was nice to meet you, Frankie. How do I find you?
He asked too quietly for Barb to hear.
Sorry, Henry. I don't think I'm ready to be found.
He touched her shoulder gently.
Take care of yourself.
Did he give those words a weight?
Who was that?
Barb asked, reaching for a potato chip.
One of your dad's friends?
He's not that old, Frankie said, staring down at the new silver bracelet she wore. With a fingertip, she traced the engraving. The major had gone missing 3 months before Frankie landed in Vietnam, while she was at Fort Sam Houston, not learning enough to deploy. How many prisoners of war were there, and why were they never in the news?
Frankie, Barb said, finishing her drink.
What is it? Memories? Do you need to talk?
Frankie looked up.
I'm glad we marched. You were right.
Barb smiled.
Girlfriend, I am always right. You know that by now.
But I think we can do more.
24. You owe me, Frankie said again. Barb stood in their small pine plank walled living room, wearing only her underpants and a bra. Their old black and white television hummed quietly behind them, Hugh Downs saying that the Nixon administration had arrested 13,000 anti-war protesters in 3 days. The footage of the Gold Star mothers and the medals being thrown filled the oval screen. After that came footage from Kent State, where the National Guard had killed unarmed students.
You're glad you went to the march.
I am, and you'll be glad we went to a fundraiser to help bring POWs home. I followed your lead, now you need to follow mine.
Why do you even want to go? You're not a Navy wife.
I was supposed to be, Frankie said gently. And for Finn. I can't imagine him stuck in a cage somewhere, forgotten.
Why don't you want to go?
Navy wives. And pantyhose. You know I haven't worn them in years. You can shimmy into pantyhose and eat lunch with other women. I'll buy you a rum and coke after.
I am going to need one.
Frankie dressed in a way that would have made her mother proud, in a navy blue knit pantsuit. Beneath the jacket, she wore a bold geometric print blouse with large pointed lapels. She pulled her hair back from a severe center part and put it in a ponytail. Frankie knew about Navy wives. Coronado was full of them. She knew they maintained a strict social hierarchy based on their husband's rank. Frankie wouldn't be surprised to learn that they still gave out calling cards to each other. But she didn't share any of this with Barb. At 11:50 a.m., she and Barb, who wore a black miniskirt and a black turtleneck and black knee boots, pulled up in front of the Hay Adams Hotel. A stream of protesters passed the hotel, marching toward the Capitol, thousands of them, intent on disrupting the government. Police in riot gear stood behind barricades.
We should be with them, Barb said.
Not today, Frankie said. Come on.
Once inside the hotel, they rode the elevator up to the rooftop, which overlooked the White House and the Washington Monument. Inside the rooftop restaurant, a giant banner had been strung up. Don't let them be forgotten. Frankie felt a shiver of emotion. They had been forgotten, even by her. At the front entrance, two well-dressed women sold tickets for the luncheon and handed out donation envelopes. Frankie bought two tickets and led Barb into the luncheon. The room reminded her of the Coronado Golf and Tennis Club, white tablecloths and bone china plates and sterling silverware. In the front of the room stood a podium with a microphone. Women in dresses and pantsuits drifted into the room, talking to one another. Several moved from table to table. The officers' wives, probably. She and Barb found two empty seats and sat down. A waiter promptly poured them wine. "See," Frankie said. "Not all bad." The room filled up slowly. Waiters moved from table to table, serving each guest tuna salad in a scooped-out red bell pepper. A slim blonde woman in a knit cornflower blue dress took to the podium and said, "Hello, Navy wives and friends. Welcome to our nation's capital. I'm Ann Jenkins from San Diego. My husband is Commander Mike Jenkins, who is currently a prisoner of war in Wallo Prison in Hanoi. I am here, along with several of my fellow wives, to seek donations in both time and money to help bring our POWs home." The room fell silent. Forks were set down. "As some of you may know, many of us have been fighting this battle for years. The information coming from the Nixon administration is shoddy and incomplete at best. The military's missing in action and killed in action reports are unreliable. Jane Adon's husband was shot down in 1966. The government first told her he was killed in action and reported that his remains were unrecoverable. She held a funeral for him. We all mourned for him. And then, 6 months ago, my husband included a mention in his letter of the perfect daylight he'd seen recently. Well, that was the name of Adon's boat. We think it may mean he is alive and at the Hanoi Hilton. But I ask you, what is she supposed to tell her children now? This is unacceptable. And Jane is not alone. I spoke with Senator Bob Dole last year, who admitted that as of 1970, most senators didn't even know what MIA or POW meant. Think about that. Last year, the people running our country, a country at war, didn't know what missing in action meant. Thankfully, Mr. Dole, a proud vet himself, is on our side, and we finally hope that the tide is turning our way. Enough of our silence. Enough asking for information politely. Enough being ladylike, being just wives. It's time that we stand up, strong and proud, as military families and wives, and demand answers. We've set up headquarters in an empty building here in D.C., and we are looking for space in San Diego, where most of us live. It is our goal to find the name of every American POW in Vietnam and put pressure on the government to bring them home. With help from our imprisoned husbands, we have been collecting a list of names. We believe we know all of the prisoners at Wallo now. We intend to become a political machine with one purpose: make everyone in this country aware of the military men in cages in Vietnam." "How?" someone asked. "We start by writing letters and giving interviews. Make our missing husbands a story that needs telling. Who is willing to write letters to bring our brave boys home?" Applause. Women stood up, clapping. Anne waited for the noise to die down, then said, "Thank you. Bless you. And if you can't write letters, please donate generously to our cause. We will make this happen, ladies. No more silence on our watch. We won't let them be forgotten." Anne nodded and left the podium, stopping at each table to say hello. She came at last to Frankie's table and paused there. "That was wonderful, Anne," said one of the women at the table. "Thank you. Lord, I hate public speaking." Anne looked at Barb, then at Frankie. "Welcome, ladies. Are you Navy wives?" "We were Army nurses in Vietnam," Frankie said. "First Lieutenants Frankie McGrath and Barb Johnson." "Bless you," the women at the table said in quiet tones. Anne said,
We all know sailors who came home because of the medical aid they received. Are you ladies from D.C.?
Georgia, Barb answered.
Coronado Island, ma'am, Frankie said.
Coronado? Anne said, looking at her.
Frankie McGrath, you're Bed and Connor's daughter?
Guilty as charged, Frankie said.
Anne smiled.
What a lovely woman your mother is. A tireless fundraiser, even after your brother's death. Bet and I chaired a beautification committee a few years ago. No one does a better event. I was sorry to hear about her stroke.
Frankie frowned.
Her what?
Her stroke. It's a reminder to all of us, isn't it? Tragedy can strike in an instant. And after all you've already suffered, please tell your father she's in my prayers.
Beneath the bright glare of white light, Frankie sat in an uncomfortable chair, staring out at the busy runways of Dulles Airport. A series of recorded announcements blared through the speakers, but it was just noise to her. The mix of people in here was a microcosm of the sharp division in America. Long-haired kids dressed in ragged jeans and bright t-shirts, soldiers coming home from war, ordinary folks trying not to make eye contact with either side. Frankie had called the house a dozen times in the past 24 hours, but not once had anyone picked up the phone. She had no way of leaving a message, so she'd called her father's office for the first time in years and found out from her father's secretary that Mom was in the hospital. 10 minutes later, she was packed and ready to fly home. At the gate for her flight, she dug through her macrame handbag for a cigarette and lit up. How could her father not have called her and told her this terrible news? Just more proof that he'd written her out of their family. When they called her flight, she put out her cigarette, slung her old travel bag over one shoulder, and boarded the aircraft. At her row, in the smoking section, she took her seat on the aisle. When the stewardess came around in her pert red and blue miniskirt uniform with matching hat and shoes, Frankie ordered a gin on the rocks.
Make it a double.
Frankie had never been to the medical center before. It was an impressive white building positioned at the top of a hill in San Diego, a glittering glass and stone architectural gem. They'd been building it the year Finley died. It was nearing nighttime when her taxi pulled up in front of the hospital. She stepped into the brightly lit lobby with its two-story wall of exterior windows and the curving wall of interior windows. Palm trees stood tall and vibrant, in contrast to the white walls and silver metal window frames. The lobby held a collection of modern, comfortable-looking, rust-colored chairs, most of which were empty on this Tuesday evening in May. A television in the corner stuttered out a canned laugh track on an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies. Frankie walked up to the front desk, behind which sat a tall, bony-faced woman wearing round glasses and bright red lipstick. A name tag identified her as Carla.
Hi, Carla, Frankie said. I'm here to see Bette McGrath.
Carla consulted a set of papers.
Family only. I'm her daughter.
Okay. She's in the ICU, second floor. The nurse's station is to the left of the elevator.
Thank you.
Frankie headed to the bank of elevators and went up to the second floor. The ICU was newer, brighter than the SICU in the Virginia hospital where Frankie worked, but it was the same series of glass rooms, with nurses moving from room to room, family members crowded at doorways looking worried, offering each other brittle smiles. At the nurse's station, she stopped, asked about her mother, and was directed to room 245, where she found her mom lying in a bed in a glass-walled room connected to a ventilator, which breathed for her. A crisscross of white straps kept the breathing and feeding tubes in place. The bed's metal railings were up on either side, and the head of the bed was angled up slightly. A stark white pillow framed Mom's head. Machines stood around her, whooshing, beeping, showing graphs of color. Frankie drew in a sharp breath. Mom was 52 years old, but looked ancient, gaunt, and drawn.
Hey, Mom.
She approached the bed slowly, pulled her mother's chart out of its sleeve, read it. Intracranial hemorrhage, respiratory failure.
She put it back in the sleeve. We don't care about statistics, do we, Mom? You're tough. I know you are.
She stared down at her mother's pale, bluish skin, her sunken cheeks and closed eyes. Frankie wanted to shut out the sound of the ventilator and imagine the natural rise and fall of her mother's chest, but she had too much training to fool herself. She knew that stroke patients on ventilators often died within the first few weeks. She brushed the back of her knuckles across Mom's soft, warm forehead. She heard footsteps and knew without looking who was here. Her dad. The man who'd once called her Peanut and carried her on his shoulders and tossed her playfully into the air until his arms must have ached from the effort. The man she'd gone to war to make proud. He paused at the door. Frankie looked up. He stared at her for a long moment, as if deliberating what he should do, and then he walked slowly forward, took his place on the other side of the bed. His fingers curled tightly around the bed rail. She saw how tanned he was, even in May, from walking job sites, overseeing construction beneath the hot Southern California sun. He wore a bright blue polyester shirt, buttoned incorrectly, and beige polyester pants. A wide, tightened belt hinted at weight loss. You didn't call me, she said.
I couldn't.
She heard the way his voice cracked and knew it had been fear that stopped him from calling, not anger. When did it happen?
A few days ago. She had a headache,
he said softly in a voice she barely recognized.
I told her to quit complaining.
Pain filled his eyes when he looked at Frankie. She'll come out of this, Dad.
You think? I mean, you're a nurse. You should know.
She's tough, Frankie said.
Yeah.
It's just the three of us now, Dad, she said. He looked up, tears in his eyes at the reminder that they'd lost Finley, that any one of them could be lost in a moment while you looked away, took a breath, stayed angry.
Will you stay?
He asked. So he felt it too. They were family. As tattered and beaten up as the connection might feel, it had a strong core, something you could hang on to. Of course, Frankie said. For the next 2 days, Frankie rarely left her mother's side. She made friends with the ICU nurses on all of the shifts and brought them donuts when she arrived in the morning. She sat at her mother's bedside hour after hour, reading books aloud, talking about anything she could think of, rubbing lotion onto her hands and feet. Dad stayed as much as he could, but she saw how difficult it was for him to be here. For a few hours every day, he went to work, just, Frankie thought, to escape the pain of waiting and watching. But then he came back, sat in the room with Frankie and Mom. He told Mom stories of their youth, retraced the steps of their love, laughed about the way her family had reacted. Frankie learned more about her dad and the depth of his love for his family than she'd learned in all the years before, but neither of them spoke to the other about it. Today, finally, the ICU team was going to take Mom off the ventilator.
What does that mean?
Dad asked for the third time as they rode up the elevator. If she does well on the readiness test, if her vitals are solid, they'll wean her off the sedation and wake her up and take out the breathing tube. Frankie saw the change in her father's posture. His shoulders sank. He kind of caved in on himself and became smaller. In an earlier version of their relationship, she might have slipped her hand in his, both giving and taking comfort, but they hadn't healed enough yet for so bold a move. Frankie had spent 2 nights in her frilly pink bedroom, had cooked him 2 dinners, and they'd spoken only about Mom. Perhaps nothing else mattered until she was better. The long silences didn't feel angry, didn't hurt Frankie's feelings. He was sad, and Frankie knew every nuance of sorrow. He just didn't know how to act without Mom, who to be, what to say. This locomotive of a man who'd rumbled so loudly through her childhood had derailed. The elevator doors opened. Frankie and her father walked down the hall, stood outside the windows of her mother's room. At 6 a.m., the ICU was relatively quiet. A team of nurses was in Mom's room, gathered around her bed, checking her readiness.
"What if she can't?"
Dad said, unable to even voice the question. "Breathe on her own." "This would be a good time for you to pray." She stepped closer to the glass window, trying to hear what the nurses were saying inside the room. Peak airway pressure, 23. That was good. Vital signs. She looked at the machines. The nurses nodded to each other. One of them picked up the phone and relayed everything to the doctor. Frankie saw the nurse nod and hang up. Wean her off sedation. Frankie felt her father move closer to her. She almost leaned against him. They watched, waiting. Through the window, Frankie saw her mother's eyelids flutter. Slowly, slowly, her eyes opened. The unit nurse extubated Mom, who immediately started coughing.
"She's breathing,"
Dad said. As soon as they were allowed into the room, Frankie and her father took their places, one on either side of her bed. Mom blinked slowly. Dad touched her face.
"Bet, you scared me."
"Yeah," she said with a lopsided half smile. Mom's head lolled to the right. She stared up at Frankie.
"My girl."
Frankie's eyes filled with tears.
"Hey, Mom."
"Frank,"
she whispered, lifting one bony, shaking hand up to be touched.
"What done to your hair?"
Frankie could only laugh. May 9th, 1971. Dear Barb and Ethel, hello from the bubble world of Coronado Island. Sorry it's taken a while to write, but it was kind of touch and go with my mom for a while. The good news is that she's out of the hospital. It will take some time for her to get full mobility, so I'm going to stay to help out. No idea how long. I've quit my job at the hospital in Charlottesville. Would you mind sending my few things here? I want you both to know how much you mean to me, and that my years with you, both in Vietnam and Virginia, have been the best of times. I'll get back to see you when I can. Until then, stay cool. Love you both. F. May 14th, 1971. Dear Frankie, you're breaking up the band, girl, and I hate it, but I think it's time. And this is the kick in the ass I needed. I've sent a resume to Operation Breadbasket in Atlanta. Maybe I'll meet Jesse Jackson. I'll miss you. Keep in touch. Stay cool. B. P.S. I'll bet Noah pops the question to Ethel now that we are out of the way. Frankie rubbed lotion into her mother's dry hands.
"That feels good,"
Mom said, struggling for the words. Frankie leaned down and kissed her mother's dry cheek. Mom's eyes fluttered shut. She tired so easily. But that was to be expected in the first few days after a stroke. She was at home, in a hospital bed that had been set up in a downstairs guest room. She was often frustrated. Sometimes she couldn't find a word, or chose the wrong word, or slurred her speech. Every now and then, a bout of vertigo made her sick to her stomach. Frankie shut the door behind her and found her father sitting in the living room. He was hunched forward. Whatever it was that had once puffed him up had been lost with Mom's stroke. "She's doing well," Frankie said.
"It's good you're here. Your mother missed you."
"And you?" He looked up, surprising her with the directness of his gaze, as if maybe he'd been waiting for this question.
"You were a different girl when you came home," he said.
"I struggled for a while after Vietnam," she said.
"We all did. After Finley, I wasn't myself. I didn't know how to..."
He shrugged, as unable to find the words as he'd been to process the grief.
I'm sorry about that last night before I went to Virginia. The things I said to you, Frankie said.
In the silence that followed her apology, she got up, walked down the hall to her bedroom, and dug through her travel bag. Finding the photograph of Finley that she'd taken down in anger, she walked back to the living room and offered it to her father.
He belongs on the hero's wall, she said quietly, putting the framed picture down on the table. I'm so sorry, Dad.
He looked at her for a long moment, then stood. He was a little unsteady. Either he'd drunk too much or eaten too little, or worry had upended him again.
Come with me.
He went to the kitchen, grabbed some keys off the hook by the wall phone, and headed out to the patio. Frankie followed him onto Ocean Boulevard. They walked down the wide cement sidewalk side by side, not speaking.
We fought about you after you left, he said at last.
Frankie didn't know what to say to that.
She blamed me, said I'd been unpleasant to you.
I was kind of a bitch, too.
I told her that.
Frankie surprised herself by smiling.
She knew you'd be back, he said.
Did she? I wonder how.
Life. Motherhood. She said something about spawning salmon.
After another half block, Dad stopped in front of a small, gray, one-story beach bungalow with a white-painted brick wishing well positioned out front on a patch of grass. An absurd bit of whimsy in this messy world. Larger, two-story houses bracketed the bungalow, made it look like a toy. A dark blue convertible Mustang was parked in the driveway.
I was going to tear this cottage down and build something bigger. And then, when you went to Virginia, your mom wanted you to have a place to come home to someday. Told me in no uncertain terms that this cottage was to be your safe place. She put her foot down. I don't think she'd ever said such a thing to me before, or to anyone. Anyway, she had this cottage painted inside and furnished it with the bare essentials. Well, bare essentials as defined by your mother. The car is my contribution.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out two sets of keys, handed them to her. Frankie was too stunned to speak for a moment. She stared up at her father, seeing him in a way she never had before, seeing a ghost of the man who'd left Ireland as a kid and crossed an ocean alone, who'd been unable to go to war with the men of his generation, who'd fallen in love with a woman who was used to having it all. The man who'd lost a son to war and almost lost his wife, who'd sent his only daughter running off into the night because he didn't know how to welcome her home. She wondered if they would ever speak of these things, the two of them.
Thank you, Dad, she said quietly.
He looked uncomfortable with her gratitude, or maybe just with the history that came with it. He glanced down the street.
I should go. I don't like leaving your mom alone for long.
Frankie nodded, watched him head for home. When he turned the corner, she walked past the gray bungalow's white-painted brick wishing well. She unlocked the door, opened it, and flipped the light switch. Inside, she found a quaint, pine-paneled living room with a soot-stained river rock fireplace and big windows with gingham curtains. Hardwood floors, an oval rag rug, a kitchen newly painted in a pale aqua, a floral overstuffed sofa, and a single chair, a vase full of silk flowers on the mantel. She moved through the place, turning on lights as she went. There were two small bedrooms, the larger of which overlooked a fenced backyard with a live oak tree at its center. Mom had furnished the room with a queen bed, a fluffy white comforter, and a small bedside table with a shell-decorated lamp. Frankie exhaled a long-held breath. Maybe this was what she'd needed all along. A place to call her own.